Hey, we are now live. Hey, folks, thanks for tuning in to the Banff Podcast. I'm your host, Mike Lafferty, and we are here today to sing the praises and hurl insults at Star Wars: The Force Awakens. And with me today is a whole bunch of smart and charming people, including Dan Houser. How you doing, Dan?
Hey, I'm good. Hello.
Great. Dan Houser, the line artist for Icons, who's also doing orc art for Green Ronin. And what else are you working on these days, man?
Oh, man. You mentioned what? Orc?
Orc.
Oh, boy. I don't know that that was out there yet. but, yeah.
I didn't say anything.
I don't know. Yes, there's that. Okay. And Icons. I'm doing some work with Owen Stevens on a mini book that he's doing. A very clever book on the land shark that is going to be real fun. And miscellaneous other projects with Jerry Sirocco and a bunch of other dudes that are out there.
Cool. I mean, good to have you back on the podcast.
Thank you. Nice to be back.
We used to podcast back in the days when it was the Vigilance Press podcast.
Oh, Lord. Yes, yes, that's true.
Long ago. So, speaking of Vigilance Press, Mr. Charles Rice is with us today as well.
Woohoo! Hey, how's it going?
Hey, it's all right. You folks probably know Chuck as the current PR man for Mayfair Games, who recently sold Settlers of Catan in a surprising move. And Chuck also recently released a great zombie RPG you can check out now called After Zombies. I've read it.
Yes.
It's a great game. You should go buy it because it's a lot of fun. So welcome, Chuck.
Glad to have Thanks.
You. And we've got Mr. Walt Rebillard of Hazard Studios. How you doing, Walt?
Doctor? Nurses in the house.
What does that mean?
Shenanigans.
Shenanigans. Yep, shamrocks and shenanigans.
Speaking of shenanigans, Mr. Chris McLaughlin, or Bring the Need famous here. How you doing, Chris?
I'm good. I kind of feel like the fake sign language guy that wandered into Nelson Mandela's funeral. I'm kind of wondering, does anybody realize that I'm here? I'm not really supposed to be, but always fun to talk to you guys.
Yeah, I appreciate it. And I am your host, Mike Lafferty, and my Neil Diamond tribute band, Cubic Zirconia, will be playing at the Boulder County National Come early for bingo, stay late for a vegan potluck. That'll be on Friday night. So, with that out of the way, Chris, I'm glad you got the joke. I'm not sure anyone else did. Let's talk Star Wars by a voice vote. Who liked The Force Awakens?
Yay!
Yay! I'm pretty sure Dan did. Walt has
I'm wearing a Kylo Ren t-shirt, yeah.
Yeah.
Yay!
All right. Chris, you didn't care for it, or you haven't seen it, or you're disdainful of Star Wars in general?
I haven't seen it. I've sort of absorbed it through osmosis, and that it's inspired some thoughts about it. But no, I haven't seen it. I probably will at some point, but I have no burning desire to see it. I have no hate for it, but I have no burning desire to see it.
All right. Can you explain your general antipathy towards all things Star Wars as a jumping off point?
Okay, well,
we all love, Chris. Why?
On one condition. When my explanation starts to eat your entire podcast, you tell me to shut up, okay?
All right, sure.
All right. Well, you see, I was there at the birth of Star Wars. I was already a huge science fiction fan. I had already devoured several really terrific films. I mean, in many ways, the 70s may have been the best decade for science fiction. And in fact, I would think, at least in my own personal opinion, the 70s is probably the best decade for cinema in general. So I was awash in this world of these complicated anti-heroes dealing with complicated issues in a world that wasn't black and white. Everybody from Michael Corleone to Chief Martin Brody. And then this film where it's got, you know, I mean, it's light, it's fun, you know, the good guy, you know, I mean, they put their irredeemable, uncomplicated black bad guys in black outfits, and, you know, they put the heroes with white hats. It's that unsubtle. The special effects for the time, of course, were outstanding, but it just seemed to be like an okay change of pace movie. But, I mean, it just doesn't seem to be anything to base your life around or anything to supplant most major world religions. You know, if I were going to pick a movie to be more popular than God, I don't think I would pick a movie where only two people can actually act. and one of them is clearly quarter-assing it and spent the rest of his life regretted being even in the movie. And so, I mean, it was okay. It was a nice aperitif after a decade of complicated, interesting films.
So Chris has been literally 55 since the age of 6.
Yes, yes. Proudly so, yes.
So just the way you said, it was fun, and, like, I could hear quotation marks around the word fun.
Within its day, it was in its way an outstanding film. Not a superb film, but a good change of pace from what was going on in that decade.
Sure. Well, now, I mean, you can go from Silent Running to Star Wars, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, you watch Silent Running, and then you're like, man, that's such a deep, like, thought, character-driven, and then you see R2-D2, and you're like, oh, screw this movie.
Yeah.
I personally never saw the original Star Wars first. I saw Empire Strikes Back first.
Well, that's probably a better place to start. So I got older, and then two things happened. I mean, I started to appreciate Star Wars less and less because I started to see the better Japanese movies that Lucas stole most of it from. And I'm like, okay, there's nothing wrong with wearing your influences on your sleeve. I'm a Tarantino fan. But it diminished the movie for me. And then by the time you get to the third film, and it's essentially become a toy commercial. The Return of the Jedi was the only film I've ever been thrown out of the theater for. Because all the parents of all the 4-year-olds had a problem with a 13-year-old guy standing up in the theater yelling bullshit at the top of his lungs. You know, touchy people. What are you going to say, right? So, I mean...
Are you making that up?
I'm totally making that up. Okay. But he's
immediately LexisNexising newspaper articles to see Chris McLaughlin thrown out of the theater.
And so now,
you got a scoop.
So now it's 2016. Now every film is space blow 'em up, very clear cut villain, very clear cut hero, very uncomplicated. Only two people can act. You have to get at least one name actor who's clearly quarter assing it. So Star Wars has gone from being a nice change of pace to every fucking film made.
You haven't seen this movie yet, right?
Well, here's the thing that strikes me about
the
film.
I'm just going to say, you're going to be really pleasantly surprised when you watch it on Blu-ray. You're going to be shocked.
Let me tell you the thing that struck me about this film so far. Everybody that I've read that hates the film and is not doing it as a cry for attention, everybody I know that loves the film says, it's just like the first movie. And I'm just utterly fascinated how that can be the film's greatest strength and its greatest weakness.
Yeah, but that's also not true. I mean, if you discount the fact that it's better written and better acted at every level than the first movie, sure, they're a lot alike.
Okay, all right. But it just, from what I know of the story, it just sounds like the same story, the same characters, only they're more diverse. But it just doesn't make me think that, you know, this is the nice change. It's gone from being a change of pace movie to every freaking film, at least from my perspective.
If you had to take something that went from being a beloved franchise into a clear mess, if you wanted to make that something palatable to everyone across the board, you'd have to start with a skeleton that everyone would recognize. And its fault is that it adheres to that skeleton very, very closely. But the depth of characters in this movie blow the first movie out of the water.
Well, it's cleared a very low bar, but I'll give it, if you say so, I'll give it credit for that.
Yeah, so I'm just saying, you'll be pleasantly surprised when you see this.
Okay, all right. You know, I guess maybe to me the heartbreaking thing about the casting was Oscar Isaac is in it. Oscar Isaac is an inside Llewyn Davis, giving one of the best performances I've seen in a film in decades, making you care about a dislikable character for nearly 2 hours.
Oh yeah,
performing original songs that he wrote with his own voice and instrumentation. And when I found out he was going to be in this movie, I'm sitting there thinking, wow, he's going from that to sitting in front of a green screen going pew, 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 pew.
There are no green screens in any of the parts that he's in.
Oh, wow, okay.
Yeah, no, this is 85%, like, this is the thing that's blowing me away, too. The Oscars are announced, and production design, Star Wars isn't nominated. Even though Really? They went back to practical sets, practical effects for like 85% of everything you see is a thing that they were in front of. So it's like I said, I'm not going to say you're going to love it, but you will be pleasantly surprised by just about everything
okay.
in this movie.
Okay. So, well, again, I don't know why you're giving so much time to the guy who hasn't seen the movie, since apparently most of my pre-impressions about it have been
it's
wrong.
It's like finding a caveman who goes, I hate Star Wars, and here's
I
a very legitimate...
I don't hate Star Wars.
I fight Star Wars to be not as entertaining
No,
as
you think it's fine. It's really exactly. okay. Honest.
I don't... Well,
that's
look...
Like, that's like finding a unicorn. Nobody's like that. Everyone has well, a strong
look,
opinion about Star
I just,
Wars.
I have yet to see anything in any of these movies that makes me want to center my life around it. My attitude is like Sir Alec Guinness. Sir Alec Guinness was once cornered in an airport by a fan that demanded an autograph because he'd seen Star Wars 600 times. And Alec Guinness, appalled that anybody would want to see that movie that many times, said, "I will give you an autograph on the condition you never watch it again." And I sit here, I mean, maybe my I guess maybe the movies themselves, the one thing that has always staggered my imagination about them is the people that refuse to watch anything else. Now, that's not the film's problem, but it just, my heart breaks when somebody tells me, oh, I've seen Star Wars 600 times, and I go, how many times have you seen Double Indemnity? How many times have you seen The Sweet Smell of Success? You know, how many times have you seen Casablanca? How many times have you seen Schindler's List? And films that are about anything other than obvious good guys, obvious bad guys, are just completely lost on them.
Yeah,
and there's a part of me that doesn't wonder if maybe Star Wars hasn't impoverished our culture at least a little bit.
But it hasn't though. I mean, that's like saying that we live in a society right now where just yesterday there was a horrific bombing somewhere in the world, and we hear about that on the news, and it's punishing to hear about gloom and despair every single day. When something comes along that's just cut and dried, here's a good guy you can root for, and here's a bad guy you want to see get their ass kicked. That is so refreshing to people, especially now, how complex our world is. To have an entertainment that's very simple is very appealing. And not just the kids, but the grown-ass people, you know what I mean?
But
so
you
not
make
everything
my point.
Has to be Casablanca.
But you make my point for me, sir. We live in a complicated world, but all our entertainment is becoming simplistic.
But that's why it's entertainment. If we want to, and if we should have entertainment that reflect our world. But come on, man, everything can't be friggin', the seventh seal.
Well, listen. Looking at the films that are coming out these days, would it be too much to ask for something to be the seventh seal?
We have that. The Revenant. The Revenant's amazing. But I wouldn't go that. When you're sitting down on a weekend, it's a Saturday afternoon, you got nothing to do. The first thing that pops in your head, you're like, I'm going to watch a movie. I'm going to sit down and watch Truffaut. No, I'm not. I would love to pretend that I am that guy, but I'm not that guy. I'll sit and watch something that entertains and helps me to forget my troubles for a little bit. And that's what Star Wars does. And I get that it does sometimes poison the well. So you get guys who are overly simplified for their lives and their tastes don't get any more refined than Pepsi when there's clearly champagne and wine and beers and everything else. But that's not Star Wars' fault, you know. It's not its fault that it's a sweet beverage. It is the person who's watching it and becomes obsessed with its fault that they're kind of an ass about it.
Well, you're absolutely right that it's wrong to blame the messenger. I mean, it's hard to get mad at a movie unless it's like Birth of a Nation or something. But still in all, you guys asked me why I'm not excited about seeing it, and
that's a perfectly good point.
I can't get excited about the seventh part of anything, much less much less a film that just, I mean, it and I'll tell you, okay, one last sad irony about this series. The most tragic thing to me about Star Wars is when Lucas actually tries to ape his film school buddy, Francis Ford Coppola, and tries to make a dark, complicated saga, he produces three of the most hated films ever produced. Now, I'm not saying they deserve all the hate, but it's really hard to think of three more movies that have been subjected to more abuse than the Star Wars prequels.
True.
You know, he actually tried to make Star Wars into something. And if you guys read Lucas's opinion of the seventh movie, the one thing he said that really resonated with me was he was sad that they didn't try to go in a different direction. He said his interest in continuing Star Wars was to try to do different things with it.
Actually, what he said was, I wanted to do something new, new aliens, new characters, new spaceships. The undertone there is, I wanted something new in versions of new things to see and new things I could sell people. You don't want to keep selling TIE Fighters and X-Wings. You wanted to sell the new thing. But
yeah,
that's not what Meatloaf is. Meatloaf is a comfort food. Star Wars is the comfort food movie. I don't put fancy things on Meatloaf or explain how a Meatloaf is made during dinner. Nobody wants to hear it. Just give me the Meatloaf. But again, if you eat Meatloaf at every meal and you only think that Meatloaf is the only thing you can eat, I hear you, Chris. But there's a difference between what you're talking about, which is a diverse palate, and just plain-ass snobbery. You know what I mean? Like, oh, it's not Jodorowsky's Dune, so therefore it's a horrible movie. You know what I mean?
I
think you're right. It's the Pepsi Cola of movies, while there are champagne and very nice IPAs out there. Pepsi's okay occasionally.
Well, that's fine. Nothing has to be Truffaut. I have Night of the Lepus on DVD. I don't want to make it sound like I'm sitting here watching everything in subtitles.
You're in a monocle with like a cigarette holder.
Yeah, but I just at 47 I can't get excited about obvious good guys, obvious bad guys, and space explosions.
Especially this from the guy who wrote Time of Crisis. How sad.
Well, but Time of Crisis does go dark on you a time or two. You have to make some complicated choices in that.
You know,
but that comes after a world where the Nazis have won World War II. There's a lot of flavors on the Time of Crisis palette.
That's true. Well, I mean, they made the
criticisms about Star Wars be applied to the glut of superhero movies we've been seeing.
Well, there you go. Obvious heroes, obvious villains. Now, I have to admit, Marvel has managed to change it up a lot more than I thought they would.
Our poor, impoverished culture. What will we do?
Well,
hey Chuck, how you doing?
Well, Chuck, are you actually trying to argue that this is a great work? That this is a great work of art?
Oh, this is a great movie. Yes, absolutely, it's a great movie. Jesus, yes.
All right,
I agree with that, Chuck.
Well, I'm glad you enjoy it. I'm happy for you.
Guys, this is me wearing a white and black striped shirt, saying "ding ding." Pause. Let's not dogpile Chris. Chuck, you have the microphone. What's your opinion of this movie?
Okay, this is the second best Star Wars movie of all time. The best Star Wars movie being Empire Strikes Back. It is written by the guy that wrote Empire Strikes Back. It has probably a better cast of characters in terms of both actors and in terms of how they're written as any Star Wars movie. It got away from all the nonsense of the prequels. I'm not sure how we're bemoaning the impoverishing of our culture and defending the prequels at the same time, but
I'm defending, just to be clarified, I am defending the notion of taking it in a more morally complex direction. Lucas's execution was terrible.
Yes, okay.
But I praise him for the idea of trying to do something more morally complicated. That's
okay.
All.
Okay. You know, by Lucas's own admission, he sold his franchise to white slavers, so now he gets to watch what someone else can do with his kids that he sold into slavery.
So you're saying he's Shmi Skywalker?
He got the money.
That's true. So you're saying he's Watto. This
movie is, to me, has a really great emotional center. It is about destiny. It is about kids who are desperate to know adult figures in their lives that have kind of been abandoned by the adults all around them, that are seeking meaning and at the same time are trying to repair the mistakes of the previous generation. It is a very moving movie.
Are we doing spoilers? We're not spoilering, or
you can spoil away.
Is that cool with you, Chris? I don't want to spoil it if you're.
I could care less, honestly. But thank you. That's very kind of me. Yeah.
Because, I don't know. You don't want to know how the Killer Shrews ends. Maybe I don't know. You know what I mean?
No. See, I don't mind spoilers. Period. So but thank you for asking. That's very kind of you. Very considerate. Thank you.
Awesome. I've been very conscious about not ruining it for people who haven't seen it yet.
Oh, I do appreciate why you wouldn't want to spoil that twist. That is for people that are into this series. That twist is a hell of a gut punch.
Oh man, with the week everyone has had this week with like David Bowie and Snape, it's like I've outlived almost all of my heroes. Lemmy, David Bowie, Han Solo, like I'm what's left of my childhood, and it's really scary to be a 40-year-old man going, holy shit,
yep.
Like. You know, this movie. Anyway, I'm sorry, Chuck was talking.
No, that's fine. I was just gonna say, there's a couple of scenes in this movie that are the most emotionally affecting of any movie I've seen in years. The death, obviously, especially the way it happens. You could argue, is Adam Driver asking Han Solo to help him, or is he asking Darth Vader to help him? Because I'm not sure. And then the end of the movie is so great and so beautiful without a single word to spoil it. Just such such a great shot.
Yeah.
The end of the movie. All right, which scene are you talking about?
I'm talking about the scene where at the very end of the movie, she's holding out
Rey and Luke's
going. Yeah, she's holding out his sword, and it's in this beautiful Arthurian setting, and he has a look on his face like, oh right, it's time for me to take up my responsibilities again. I'm a knight who put his sword down and walked away, and maybe that was a terrible idea.
Yeah, Chris, like I said, there's more actor-worthy acting from Mark Hamill in this movie than you've ever seen in any other role he's ever done in the 3 minutes he's on the screen. It is just a stunning moment in the history of Star Wars. You're like, oh my god! Like you actually read on his face without him saying something.
Yes.
You know.
That's good because honestly, I've seen him do other things, and of all his performances, I've always thought his Star Wars performances were like the weakest thing in his body of work.
Yeah, he really plumbed some depth in Corvette Summer, I think.
That's the funny thing. He's better in Corvette Summer, which was made at the same time. He has to carry that film.
I thought he was really
between
good.
Star Wars and Empire, wasn't it?
It was.
Yeah.
That's how he got his face all messed up.
Yeah.
That was facetious, but The Big Red One was actually a pretty decent horror movie.
Oh, well, yeah, hard to go wrong with Sam Fuller.
It is. Speaking of war movies, Walt, what'd you think about this?
Oh, I always got to be the war guy.
Easy transition.
The thing I really like about the movie is the inspiration that it's giving people. I like the fringe stuff that's going on. I enjoyed the movie, so I mean, there's that. It was nice to have a thing where I could go somewhere with my wife and we could both giggle and eat popcorn, you know, and that's what I enjoyed of it. But I really like the creativity coming from this, especially from social media. A friend of mine is a Border Patrol agent, and he finds the most interesting posts online that really cater to my inner infantryman. And he found a post talking, you know, where this guy was rebutting somebody had, and to go to what some of Chris was saying, this has some of the most intense fan reaction I've ever seen in a film that has bled over into pretty much every part of social media. So this guy gets on and says, you know, this is bullshit. Kylo Ren facing off against two kids with no combat experience, blah blah blah. And this soldier comes up and saw the movie and really enjoyed it with his kids and kind of felt offended by that. And he said,
He wrote this long post on Reddit, and it's been blowing up all over the place, and it's hysterical. I must have read it like three or four times just because of how funny it was, where he's talking about the how they should have strapped Chewbacca's bowcaster on a TIE fighter and used that instead of a Death Star because that's how powerful it was. So, I mean, and he goes out into how Kylo Ren faced off against these two kids, but he had been messed up because he got shot by Chewbacca.
Yeah, he got shot by the bowcaster.
And because this is very deft filmmaking, and I use that word very specifically, they show you what a bowcaster does to a guy wearing armor over and over again. You see stormtroopers flipping through the air when they get shot with this fucking thing. And so Kylo Ren holding his guts in and fighting these guys isn't like, oh, it's so stupid. It's like he did what he was supposed to do as a director. The writer and director did their jobs, you know? Yeah.
There is a lot of fan reaction around this movie.
It's crazy.
And the amount of creativity that's coming from it. I even saw a great meme the other day where Chewbacca sitting on a bench taking care of baby Kylo Ren.
Yeah.
And then as he gets into his teenage angsty years, he gets, you know, very like, dark side, blur, and Chewbacca, you know. The artist did a really great job of conveying the hurt of a parent. Seeing a kid going in the wrong direction. And then the last panels are Chewbacca seeing Han having his issue and looking at the scope through the scope at Kylo Ren. You know, how do you shoot that child that you helped raise? You know, I mean, so the thing I'm really enjoying about this film is not so much the film itself, because to talk about what Chuck was saying, it's a better made Episode 4. The thing I really enjoy.
How amazing that is, though.
Yeah,
that's a movie that changed cinema, that people are still watching, that the last time it was released in theaters, which was 20 years after its first release, it was still the number one movie, and this
exactly.
is better.
Yep, exactly, and that's definitely an accomplishment on its part, but I think that the real accomplishment is the fact that it's inspiring so many people. And yes, it might not be the pinnacle of film and cinema, but it's doing the one thing that a lot of movies don't do, and it's making people feel something. And like we have films like I know Chris is a stalwart champion of Man of Steel, and is probably looking forward to that next one with the troll from Lord of the Rings. When you walk out of a movie,
Batman's in that movie.
When you walk out of a movie like that, and you're just like, ugh, and you feel parts of your childhood being stepped on, and you walk out of Star Wars, and you're feeling parts of your childhood being revived, I can definitely see Star Wars' place and why it's such an important film for this particular year.
Well, I will say this much. If I have to choose between pure optimism and pure pessimism, that's no choice at all.
This
but again,
means
I don't think this movie is it's not cotton candy, I mean, either.
Well, do the bad guys win at the end? Then,
Yes.
Really?
So that's your
seriously.
Definition.
Seriously.
Yes.
All the movies where the good guys win are cotton candy and are to
no,
be disregarded.
I'm just saying if it's a bunch of obvious good guys beating a bunch of obvious bad guys and in a shocking twist ending the good guys win, well, I mean I've only got a limited number of times in my life that I want to spend seeing that same story.
That's a good point. But in this movie, they frame the victory of the bad guys in a Pyrrhic victory for the good guys. The end of this movie leaves the good guys in tatters, getting by on the scraping by the skin of their teeth, and it's left with a question of, okay, what good can come of any of the things that happen at the end of this movie? Your primary male protagonist is in a coma. The female protagonist is unsure of her future and has to go find somebody we don't know if they're good or evil. And the villain is just fine and going to go be stronger. That's and the Republic, the Senate is destroyed. Everyone's right. Dead.
Yeah.
And there's no fleet. So the guys from Rogue Squadron are all that's left, and there's no fleet to back them up anymore.
Well,
so this next movie, all this expectation with it, it's going to be awesome, in my opinion.
Okay. I don't know why you guys keep asking the one guy who hasn't seen it. But
and again, I don't take this. It's not meant personally. I don't take it personally. Because well, let me get the nice part. It does sound like a more interesting film than the way you describe it, but it's hard for me to tell from your description. Is it a better film or just an incomplete film? I mean, not having seen it, I can't really say if this is all moral ambiguity and complexity, or we have to make sure that people want to see parts 8 through 57.
You know, let me just say, I've seen the movie once and I probably won't see it again. I really enjoyed it. The ending does feel like more of an Empire Strikes Back ending. I'm not a huge fan of J.J. Abrams. I think what he does is make... he's a good ringmaster. He makes an entertaining circus. I saw his 2 Star Wars movies. I enjoyed them both. I didn't think either one of them should have been a Star Wars movie. I thought this was the first good Star Wars
movie. You mean Star Trek?
Exactly. Sorry, I blame the liquor. I think this is the first good Star Wars movie since Empire Strikes Back. I didn't care for any of the prequels or Jedi, and I'm very conscious while watching it. Yeah, Disney wants to make some return on the $3 billion. Having said that, he's a good enough ringmaster. He does work some artistry in there. Some of the shots, the cinematography, the writing, as Dan mentioned, the writing and direction is very deft. So, I mean, I'll compare it to a circus because it's a well-run circus. I'll have to see the rest of them. But
another really interesting point, Chris, too.
Okay.
Which because you're a cinemaphile, you'll get why this is awesome.
Okay.
Uses some of the same lenses from the first episode 4. So there are shots that are clearly film shots from classic 70s cinema, and you'll be like, and there are moments like Rey is escaping from the bad guys in a moment that's kind of ambiguous, but there the shot of these stormtroopers coming down the hallway that is just classic. Like you're watching, you're like, man, this looks like something that was shot in 1978. It's amazing. Again, you'll be very pleasantly surprised when you see it. That's all I'm going to say.
Okay, well, I'll look forward to that. You know, as an aside, Walt just made me think the most depressing thing I've thought in a while. I know you did it on purpose, but listening to you guys describe this film and having brought up Man of Steel, all I can think about is, oh my God, if Abrams were doing Man of Steel, I'd be excited about seeing that movie. I'd already have my ticket for that. Because whatever gifts and flaws he has as a filmmaker, he just seems like he would be so perfect for that source material.
If he enjoys it, I get the feeling that if he enjoys the brand, he polishes the brand up. With Star Trek, he was like, I love Star Wars. Let me make a resume for Star Wars.
Well, you know, well, think about it. He's obviously been obsessed with this, with the core story of the first Star Wars, of the kid who, realizes his special gifts and becomes a mythic hero. Oh my freaking God! That's the Superman origin story. Let him make that.
Yeah.
Oh, but it's in Zack Snyder's hands because there's evil in the world.
Zack Snyder's not the problem. It's David S. Goyer. Zack Snyder is a competent, visually arresting director. I like his movie's visual look, but David Goyer writes garbage. And one tone. Did you see? Okay, if you don't believe me, Blade 3, he directed and wrote that pile of shit. So that's at the core of every Superman movie coming out. Every Justice League movie is that nugget of Blade 3 where Triple H fights a fucking vampire poodle. That's the middle of it. Like, not Zack Snyder, who has to go, well, this is a script you're giving me. This is really kind of grim. Do they really have to destroy an Eastern Seaboard to get the point across that Superman am strong?
Have you heard Patton Oswalt's story about making Blade 3?
Yes!
Yes.
And it's so much better than the actual film!
It really is. But isn't that weird that he's actually part of the Marvel Universe?
The whole time, and would only show for close-ups. Everything else in that movie starts to come together.
Well, I want to ask you guys a favor, if I may. After Batman vs. Superman comes out, and that immediately makes me go out and buy the 8 Blu-ray special edition of Force Awakens, you know, please don't be too hard on me. Please don't.
Dude, we need to do a podcast right after Batman vs. Batman v. Superman, the courtroom battle of the century, where Batman gets custody of the awesome things in DC Universe, and everyone else gets the shaft.
Yeah.
I'm going to say because Batman's in it. That's my reason.
You talking about Shaft? Richard Roundtree.
Damn right.
Let me just,
right out.
As way of an awkward segue, Marvel Annihilation event was not great literature. I really enjoyed it. It was a good Nova Corps story. It was a good use of Marvel Cosmic characters, which hadn't been used much in, oh, fuck, how long? I mean, 2 decades since I've been a Marvel Cosmic story worth talking about. So I would compare the Marvel Annihilation event, you know, to Star Wars The Force Awakens. Someone knew how to put the toys out and make them interesting again. And speaking of cosmic comic universes, Chris wrote, or had a large hand in writing, Mutants and Masterminds Cosmic Handbook, which we're giving away on this podcast.
Yes, we are.
We are. So email me at mikelaff@gmail.com with the phrase cosmic giveaway in the subject line. And we're going to give you a PDF because the hard copy is not out yet. Why is that, Chris? When's that coming out? Do you know?
I don't know. I'll sign your PDF if you like.
I got Photoshop.
Digitally signed by Chris McLaughlin. And would like to thank Alan Wilkinson in the UK who won our Emerald City giveaway. Appreciate everyone who sent in entries. And Alan received that a couple weeks ago. So I think we're going to make giveaways a regular thing on the podcast because they seem to be popular. So when you were writing your parts of the Cosmic Handbook, Chris, did you what were you thinking about as far as like what influences you wanted to incorporate or what you wanted readers to take away?
You know, there's sort of an interesting personal resonance for me because I'm on this Star Wars podcast, mostly wondering why I'm here, and and then they asked me to be on Cosmic Handbook, and my initial reaction was, why do you want me on the Cosmic Handbook? What have I ever done that's okay? I'll give it a shot, and to me, the history part was the easiest part to write. I mean, I love writing about comic book history and just being a smart aleck about it all. There were a few snarky things cut out that I regret, but that's true of everything that I write. But that flowed very naturally and led to my encounter with Jim Starlin being stalked by the drugged out guy, which I think I probably told that story. So that was a fun section to write. Then the thing that really, really struck me was the thing about cosmic themes, because it actually got me not so much into the cosmic comics, because I was sort of going off memory for a lot of those, but just looking at more of the like pure sci-fi comics and how they broke down the genre tropes, and really, really, really thinking about what good, hardcore classic science fiction has to say, how they tell stories, and how that's been adapted to the comic book medium. And it was fun. That part was fun for me to write because I think I developed a greater appreciation of the link between that golden age of 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s sci-fi, and how that translated into comics, thanks to guys like Julie Schwartz. So that was great fun. And I actually took a chance on a crunchy section. I actually came up with a system for different levels of omnipotent beings in case you ever wanted to have an omnipotent being fight, which seems to me is something that you should have happen in a cosmic game every so often. And I wrote that out thinking, well, Lighthouser's going to cut this. Nobody's going to see this because, I'm not exactly known for my crunch, and that's fair. And sure enough, it's in there verbatim. You never know what's actually going to see print. And that seems to be the thing that people I'm seeing a lot of talk about. Like, wow, I can have gods fight now? Okay, cool. So by accident, I seem to have done something really good and really crunchy. So that was a fun surprise about the whole process.
Cool. What kind of response? I mean, it sounds like you're seeing a lot of positive response from M&M fans about it.
Yeah, we are. Once we got past the, holy crap, it's actually out. And that was totally deserved. That was totally deserved. I mean, I'm only a Ronin freelancer, but I think everybody at the company would have to own up to, yeah, it's totally deserved to get that. But yeah, I think I was really, really happy that once people got a look at it, and I had dinner with Christmas around Christmas time with the guys in charge of our graphics, Hal Mangold, and we were talking about how absolutely perfect the sort of Guardians of the Galaxy tribute team were. And I don't want to spoil it if you haven't seen it, but instead of having a raccoon, he's substituted another, I think, even more hilarious animal type character in that role. And we were just. I don't want to spoil it, but anyway, but we were just so happy that it's a book that I think maybe more than some other books that we've done, it just, the visuals just really get you in the mood for what we're trying to do and what we're trying to sell and what we're trying to say. So I just the way the book looks seems to be something people are embracing, and I couldn't be happier because I think that's totally deserved.
Have you seen any response about people playing it and using it already?
Not quite yet, but I'm excited to see what people will do with some of these ideas, because to me, just if I can speak in general, the great thing for me about being in the role playing industry is I kind of feel like talk about an out of proportion comparison, one of those great 70s artists like James Brown, and like 40 years later, people are remixing your tunes, putting their own beats and their own rhymes, and just seeing what people are doing with the things that you put out there. You know, I was totally blown away by a guy who took Time of Vengeance and made it and set it in World War II, and how that played in that era, which I have to admit I was skeptical going in, but wow, the execution on it was really, 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 really nice. So I'm just really, really interested to see, you know, I've thrown out all these things, well, the sci-fi genre does this, the sci-fi genre does that, and I'm kind of interested for somebody to get a hold of it and say, yeah, but look what else the sci-fi genre can do.
Let me ask you a question. I know one frustration I've had as a publisher is how do you, because you look on forums, if you do a Kickstarter, everyone's excited, there's a lot of chatter about it, people mm-hmm. get books and silence. And, you know, I've got a writer for a book we did a couple years ago, had a huge Kickstarter, you know, broke $10,000, book did really well.
Uh-huh.
And he's trying to find chatter about it online, and there's just nothing. And I mean, you get more discussions when. I'm sorry?
Which one?
We did a book called Extreme Earth. That.
Oh, right. I would say that it's because the people buying these to use them are DMs, and they don't give away what they're going to do in the next game.
Yeah.
Because their players are going to read it. They're going to go, aha, here's the plan. Because I know that there are DM, like, in the forums, there's like, DMs only. I swear to God, I don't put anything in there because my players don't care about that label. Click. Hey, that's what we're going to go up against. Gee, why did you buy all that silver weaponry just now? No reason. Okay.
You know, I'm reminded of a werewolf. I'm sorry. I was reminded of a quote from Steve Kenson. Steve Kenson and I were hanging around the booth at Gen Con when you were talking about online response to our books. And he said that... you know, that is almost never going to be reflective of what's actually going on, because the people that buy your stuff and enjoy it are too busy actually playing to actually get back to you about it. It's the person that flung your book down in disgust and has nothing better to do but trash you online that you're ever going to see a personal comment from. Okay. So yeah, you have to keep that in mind. You have to keep that perspective.
Maybe asking for a review in the middle of a meal, like if you're like a restaurant critic, and they were asking your opinion during the meal while you're eating.
Yeah, kind of, sort of.
It's like, I'm busy eating. I'll tell you when I'm done. I think the reviews come when the next product comes out and everyone buys it, because they trust the brand at that point.
Yeah.
From fans at conventions, are we going to have a drink with them, or is it not really online stuff, and you got the grumpy guys who never leave the forum because they do, so it's not really too valuable, or where do you find you get the best information for that kind of thing, or do you?
You know, honestly, myself, I kind of feel like I'm operating in a bit of a vacuum, because I, like I said, if you find anything online, it's probably negative, and believe me, I have seen fair negative criticism. It's out there, but it doesn't change the fact that most online criticism is just batshit insane. You know, I still remember the guy who trashed. I can't remember if it was Time of Vengeance or Silver Age, because he said the writing was too friendly. And I wanted to get his email address and write him back and say, fuck you! Do you like it better now? Does the book work better for you now? Yeah. So, yeah. You know, so
I think Chris gave a chair shot to go back to our pre-podcast conversation.
Yeah. So,
right in the fucking post. Bang!
You know, so I... Yeah. So I and people, but I to me, I go by the people it shows. I mean, somebody who, with all the different things they could be saying and doing at a convention, they come by to say something nice about your work. And I tend to be a very in-jokey, Easter eggy type of writer. And the people that have said nothing online but have come up to me and go, oh, yeah, I totally got that reference to that obscure 1955 film noir. I just want to hug those people. But I understand you go to jail for that these days. So I give them a polite nod. So, but in deep inside, I want to hug. I'm a hugger by nature. I want to hug these people.
Well, all right. I got nothing to say about that except
you need a hug. Oh, Chris, what you see him. You need a hug.
I probably do, yeah. So, hey, I wanted to ask you about something, Chris, since you're a historian and a Southerner.
Oh, good Lord. Yes.
You know, I know it's loaded. I'm sorry for setting it up that way.
Okay.
You're familiar with this Newton Knight guy, right?
I'm sorry, who's that?
Newton Knight, he was a Confederate deserter during the Civil War. Tried to set up a free state of Jones in Jones County, Mississippi. And a small fighting force of freed slaves and other deserters.
I'm vaguely aware of it. I have to admit that as a Southerner, it's really, really, really hard to read what happens at the after war stuff, because whatever else you want to say about living in the South and being Southern, that's not exactly the era that my part of the country was covered in glory and had a lot of things to be proud about.
This was actually during the war. He tried.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he tried to secede with form his own little country with some other deserters and some free slaves. And he had a common law marriage to a free black woman. And anyway, Matthew McConaughey is playing him in a movie. You'll probably be hearing a lot more about towards the summertime.
I've seen a trailer for it, and it brought back, for better or for worse, it brought back some Heaven's Gate memories. So I hate to color it with such a divisive film as that, but that's the vibe I was getting. It seemed to be like somebody wanting to tell a really big story with an obvious point of view. So I'm kind of fascinated to want to see it from the trailer, because it's one of those films where you can tell the director has a point of view, and even if it's not carried out to its fullest extent, even if he's insane, what I like to call going all Zardoz on me, I kind of like those films just because it's just so nice to see a film that tries to say something.
Are you trying to say you sat through Heaven's Gate? Like, you sat through that post part of a movie?
Long flat shot after long flat shot.
You did not.
Okay. I sat through the theatrical release once. I have never bucked up enough courage to sit through the reconstructed version, which I understand is something like a week long.
It's like fucking Andy Warhol's Sleep without the fucking plot. It's the worst thing I've ever seen. I've seen Ishtar. I watched Ishtar in the fucking theater. And this movie is terrible. Give me 85 Star Wars movies, and you can keep Heaven's Gate. Which it's a matte painting. That's what it is. Oh my god, sorry. I was like, oh. At first I was like, he's talking about The Cult. No, he's talking about that horrible, shitty film. It's like The Deer Hunter. It's like the wedding scene in The Deer Hunter lasted the rest of your life. And I've been to weddings that were shorter than the fucking Deer Hunter's wedding. Sorry. I'm also a film fan, Chris. I just happen to be a little bit more loosey-goosey about what I like.
I have Monster a Go-Go on DVD, not the Mystery Science Theater version. I'm not questioning anyone. I'm not saying anyone else has no tastes. I'm just saying I'm more fond of complicated fare at this point in my life.
So you're more of a Guardians of the Galaxy type guy.
Well, here's the thing. I actually thought Guardians of the Galaxy was a deeper film than anybody gave it credit for. And I have absolutely no problem with a film being fun. I have all the beach party movies on DVD. I don't mind a little fun, but just I put it to you this way, okay? Jacques Barzun once defined decadence as a culture that strains artistically, and in the end all it does is repetition. and it struggles even to do that. So I just kind of feel that's where America is right now, and it just there's a limit to how much I could be to seeing part 7 of anything.
You know what had a lot of parts was the Odyssey.
I'm hearing music.
Is someone in an amusement park?
Yeah, someone right on a merry-go-round. Does one of us drive an ice
cream truck during the music podcast? All the time.
Walter, are you driving a Zamboni right now?
No, it's not me. It's my microphone's on mute when I'm not speaking, so it's not me.
Okay, well. I heard Chuck say something about the Odyssey, and I was like, oh, I'm in for it now, and then all of a sudden we're at the skating rink.
That's a crazy clown who's waiting to stab you if you answer wrong.
He's standing behind you right now.
It's probably some angry guy with a lightsaber getting ready to silence the non-believer.
I do not own one of those. I own 2 t-shirts from this movie, though, because it's really good. And I support things I like with merch purchases.
I used to work with a guy who was a very hardcore Star Wars fan, and we worked together during the long drought after the prequels, before the Clone Wars. And I used to troll him by being like, hey, man, Dean, did you know they're doing a Star Wars musical? He's like, oh. I'm like, yeah, but he's singing Wookiees. It's happening. And then we'd hear it to you, and I'd be like, dude, I was fucking with you. But it was great because he always took it seriously. Although now someone from Disney is probably hearing this and going, hey, we did a Spider-Man musical. Why not a Star Wars
musical? Nope. They already tried music in Star Wars. It didn't work. That was a Star Wars holiday special. Carrie Fisher sings the lyrics to the Star Wars song, but it's kind of a Christmas song, but it's also kind of the worst thing that's ever happened to humanity.
But I must say, the riff tracks of the Star Wars holiday special is hilarious.
Exquisite.
Yes.
It's exquisite.
That is probably my favorite Star Wars thing ever.
You know, I got something for you guys. You ever go to Wikipedia? No, you're cool people, so you don't. But if you do...
I do!
If you do, you know what the style of music that is played by Max Rebo's band is called?
He's a jizz whaler.
He's a jizz whaler. Why is no one else laughing? He's a jizz whaler.
Because we're too horrified.
Because when I heard what that term was when I was like 11, I didn't know anything. So that's just what it was. And then later I'm like, oh, well, George, he's a jizz whaler. Are you fucking serious right now? Nobody on the crew goes, wait, what? We're not putting that on the fucking toy. You know that, right? He's a blue elephant man. We're not going to put that on a blue elephant man toy.
No.
If you want to look at it from a drive-in perspective, you've already done kissing your sister. What else are you going to do to shock people twice. other than just go full-blown human centipede at some point?
Wookiee centipede. All matted fur and growling.
There you go. Save that for part 57.
Actually, you can do that with R2-D2 toys, apparently. I've seen it online.
I'm out. If you bring it out.
Goddamn. All right. I don't know how to end this podcast gracefully after that.
Hey, you brought up Jizz Whalers and this fucking bullshit Heaven's Gate movie. What the fuck, Heaven's Gate? Oh, God. It's like I felt it. You know that scene in Princess Bride where they fucking strap the guy down and you can feel his life getting sucked out of him? That's Heaven's Gate. That's what they should do. Strap you down and you can feel your life ebbing away. Because the minutes are just creating entropy on your skin.
Well, if you want an optimistic ending, everybody seems to be having a good time, and who knows, maybe this will encourage somebody to go watch The Hidden Fortress. And, everybody wins.
Absolutely. Oh, also, you mentioned Oscar Isaacs, and I want to end on this note because his character isn't on screen for more than probably 20 minutes total in this film. But he captures you in the first. They made such a genius choice in this character, and he's going to be in the next movie and the one after that. So he becomes a bigger part, but he is the reason why you love this movie at the beginning because he sets the tone perfectly. There's a sense of adventure and fun that he brings to it that's just... It was like getting a nice cold glass of water after being in a desert forever. Because there's been no fun or joy in Star Wars for, 20 years now? It's all been either crass marketing or experimental, like, cinematography and computers and shit.
Don't forget with, all the riveting, trade negotiations we got to see.
Exactly. Okay, but you know what? Fuck that. That whole thing, they should have been... There's one sentence that needs to be added to that crawl. But it's just a lie by the Emperor to invade Naboo. If they'd added that sentence, nobody would ever talk about that shit again, because that's all the whole point of it was. But they're like, wait, what, really? There's taxes in space? Who gives a shit?
Well,
why is taxes in this movie?
Well, you know, okay. I actually read something interesting about Star Wars, and it obviously means a lot more to you guys than it does me. So I'm just curious how greater fans of this might react to it. I understand there's something out there called the Rogue Cut, where, like, if you want to watch the original movies, you just don't watch Episode 1 at all.
Yeah, there's a chainsaw cut where there's scenes from Episode 1 that are put into Episode 2 that replace the shitty love story.
Yeah, but I'm just curious. How much better does it work if you just pretend there was never an Episode 1? Is it that much better?
No, not really.
Look, for me, I'm not a hater. Like, I didn't hate anything about Episodes 2 and 3 other than the stilted wooden acting between two people who had no chemistry. But it seemed like they were trying to do the same thing they did in the original movies, where certain actors were just kind of wooden and weird. So I was like, well, maybe this is a stylistic thing. But the first movie, the child is far too young, and Jar Jar is far too experimental and goofy to work. And he hung all of his things on that hope that Jar Jar works. The documentary is very clear on this. He's like, if Jar Jar doesn't work, then we're kind of screwed. And it's like, yeah, no shit, because he's right, a fucking guys? Rabbit fish man. And
yeah.
But without Jar Jar, you don't get Gollum, and you don't get Rocket Raccoon, and you don't get Groot. You don't have people willing to put a completely computer-generated character among real actors and not just bullshit, hand-wave it and say, no, it's Roger Rabbit. So thank you, Jar Jar, for being the first one to fail. The first monkey in space who died immediately after liftoff. Just pressure killed him.
But no, sadly he did not. We got 3 movies of him.
No, I pretended that Naboo was one of the planets that got blown up in this fucking movie.
Okay.
He got fucking destroyed. Although there's a review, Red Letter Media does like a review of the movie, or of what they hope is in the movie, and what they hope was a scene that goes, oh my god, someone has totally desecrated the tomb of Senator Jar Jar Binks. They've smeared feces all over it. I was like, yes, that scene would be perfect. But the movie does begin with, I hope this begins to make things right. That's the first line in this movie. So, yes, they do expose their ass and shit all over the prequels in the first sentence of this movie. Also, the crawl says nothing about taxes. It just talks about Luke Skywalker.
Hey, quick question for you, Chris, as a critic of general culture. No, I mean,
okay.
You had mentioned some, you know, critiques of what's happening in movies right now. And
okay.
I've heard a lot of that. I mean, it's a valid point of view that we got a lot of what you call, you know, 20, 30 years ago, they'd be called B-movies. Now they're just, you know, popcorn blockbusters. And it seems like we get an awful lot of them. And it might be squeezing out, say, more serious fare. I mean, I've heard some people opine that.
Yeah, you know, I was a interview that Roger Corman did for one of the Shout Factory discs that he put out. And they were asking him how filmmaker had changed since he started out. And he was talking about how if you wanted to do a movie about battles in space when he started, you had to round up $50,000 and find a friend with a really big basement to shoot it all in. You know, if you wanted to do films about complicated adult stories with emotions, well, the only way you could do that would be to go to a big studio. And he said now it's completely reversed itself. Those big studios are planning their big bucks into superhero movies and part 57 of this particular series. And if you want to find like really complicated adult, no really pat ending stories, those are the ones being shot in somebody's basement for $50,000.
Well,
are the modern equivalent thereof.
Let me ask you a question.
Okay.
Well, that's happening on the movie level. We're having a golden age of creativity on TV.
Oh, God, yes. Yeah, I mean, seriously. I mean, yeah.
We can start rattling off series, but, I mean, there's just been so much good TV and so many different genres over the last 5-10 years. Do you think maybe what's happening is film is why this is happening in TV? Is people who want to tell interesting stories say, well, fuck, I'm not going to get this to a theater because they want to make, you know, the next superhero blockbuster, so I'll take it to Netflix, or I'll take it to AMC or something.
Well, it's really, really, really hard to praise TV and TV in general because it seems like the middle has dropped out of TV. You know, I mean, yeah, you got stuff like Game of Thrones and Walking Dead and Daredevil and Jessica Jones and Powers, which I think is a really underrated show. I love to plug at every opportunity.
Yeah,
but, you know,
yeah.
but let's not forget that, you know, at the same time that we're getting stuff like this, you know, we've got like, you know, little person tattoo, Amish polygamy, rescues pit bulls and lives in Louisiana and apparently hasn't realized the culture hasn't changed since 1804. You know, I mean, it's looking like the bad TV's gotten even worse. Granted, like, the cream of TV is as good as it ever was. I mean, in some ways, we're as spoiled as audiences were when they could watch Playhouse 90 and stuff like that. And a dumb show was something like I Love Lucy, which, God, is still funny after 60 years. You know, that was considered to be the TV wasteland when you had stuff like The Honeymooners on. So, you know, I mean, I just looks like the bottom is let's not forget the bottom has dropped out of TV. But thank God, yes, there is some really outstanding shows. The bottom and the middle has dropped to the bottom.
I think that might be because, like, would you go to IMAX to watch Love Story?
Well, I love...
Or Casablanca, even. Would you go to IMAX to watch Casablanca?
Yeah.
Nobody wants to watch a screen with two giant fucking heads talking to each other. And that I think it's just because that's how, when you're a kid, you're kind of conditioned to say, well, if I'm seeing something big, I want something big to be happening.
Well, for
but
me,
I've got a pretty big TV at home.
You know, for me, it's always been, you know, what are these heads saying, and do I give a crap about what happens to them?
Sure, but I mean, cinematically, I think that audiences now want to see, because of the ticket prices and the prices of concessions, it's now a trip to the movies. It's not like you pay your buck and go see the thing that's going to be on the screen. You're now going to go on an adventure ride at an amusement park kind of level of expectation when they go into that theater. Like Grindhouse is a good example of that for me. I loved that movie, and I loved that pair. But it was just like it was like walking into an amusement park experience. You know what I mean? Rather than I'm going to go walk in and watch ordinary fucking people. I mean, that movie plays for meemaws and peepaws and like, you know, romantic couples on their first date, but that's not what audiences want when they pay $20 to sit down into a giant theater, you know?
Well, the studio started in the 70s, right? I mean, that's where movies like Lawrence of Arabia come from. They needed spectacle to compete with TV, because TV was at that point killing movies.
Because you could tell those small stories on that screen and that personal screen and that personal space, and you're not sharing those emotional moments with a bunch of people, and you didn't pay top dollar for that entertainment.
Joss Whedon says TV is often radio with faces, and I think that's 100% true. It's the writer.
Yeah. I think Battlestar Galactica is probably the best soap opera I've seen in, I mean, leaving out Star Wars. I mean, there was some horrible stuff in Battlestar Galactica, and the finale leaves a lot to be desired, but I mean, there was some smart writing in some of those episodes that I don't think I've ever seen, you know, not in recent memory, you know, done in a science fiction movie on the big screen. With all apologies to Star Wars.
Well, I'd like to respond to the comment about what audiences want. I don't know if any of y'all are. Well, I'm guessing everybody here knows Kevin Murphy from Mystery Science Theater and Riff Tracks.
$12.
Oh, wow. And if you haven't read his book, A Year at the Movies, I would highly recommend it to anybody that has cared about such a silly thing as movies to any degree. But the great point about that book is about modern audiences is, if you ask your average person about your average movie, you get the same answer. It's okay. Kevin Murphy believes, and I agree with him, that far too much of the audience has been trained to accept that as the cinema norm. Murphy is a big fan of, why not put more good films out there and see what happens? You see, I'm a believer in a world where, yes, there should be fun movies that everybody can enjoy. But is there not room for something like Inception?
Obviously there is. We have Inception.
Well, exactly.
The centerpiece of Inception.
No one is strangling Inception in the crib.
But let me finish my thought. Before we go to make part 27 of whatever series, or we go back and make Snorks into a five episode saga, you know, let's give another filmmaker a chance to make his own Inception. Those are the ideas that are being strangled out of cinema.
Okay, but this is ultimately a business, right? We're going to have to agree on that, that they have to make money to continue. I think the Miramax ideal is a good idea. I wish there were more studios yes. out there, but it's better that there's so many people who are able to do these mumblecore movies on their own. Mm-hmm. Because now it's, as Kevin Smith says, the means of production are now available to just about everybody.
Yep.
You know, who wants to put together 10 grand? You can actually make a movie with that so long as you have a decent script and some good actors. You know? And like, for example, Hateful Eight. That movie cost them $200,000 to make, I think. There's some ridiculously small amount for the actual production portion of it. It was the actual equipment they used that cost any amount of money. And maybe it was something small, but still a huge number, $70 million or something. But it's like, that was a guaranteed going to make money because it's a Quentin Tarantino movie. But, you know, it has to have something to it or nobody's going to go see it because of the economics of film.
And absolutely.
That's why, but that's why there's franchises. That's why there's a Star Wars 7 rather than new sci-fi spectacles, a.k.a. Battlefield Earth, or Fifth Element, I guess, would be a better example. Like, why there aren't many Fifth Elements, because it's hard. You can't catch lightning in a bottle every time, and that'll kill a genre if you don't have a sure thing where something can slide in with it. That's why I like Guardians of the Galaxy so much. They took what's not a sure thing, and a company that's willing to bet on it and come out with something awesome and original, even from an owned property, you know?
There are still great movies like Whiplash being made. I mean,
yeah,
I don't understand the concept that, you know, that we're not getting good movies. I think we're getting plenty of serious movies.
We are also drowning in IP. You know, like franchise films, because of the economics of it. I think it's what we're going to have to live with, because that's what a movie is now. You know, a movie is going to a mini amusement park because of ticket prices and kind of we don't have a theater where there's a curtain that opens to bring you to the new world. It's just a big screen. It's a big TV. Mm. Only it's bigger and louder than your TV at home. Seriously, this is going to be an old man statement. I'm 40 now, but when I was a kid, I remember the curtains opening on a theater. You know, when I was a projectionist, there are cues you would put in the film to open the curtains, you know, or raise the curtains if it was a raising curtain. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and that you felt like, oh, the movie is beginning. This is the movie event. There's no more of that.
Yeah. You know?
It's anachronistic to think that there's a piece of cloth in front of a screen now. You know, it's like an 80s bordello. It's like an 1880s bordello. Like, oh, look, the fancy velvet roof comes up. Oh, there's the space monster. Nope. It's just, now you get there and you're watching fucking regular TV on commercials the second you sit down with your Coke and your popcorn.
Mm.
Then I lament that the days of the minor movies, of the big idea movies with low effects, like the actual heart and soul movies, are gone. But they're there. They're on Netflix, and they're on the internet being made by Kickstarters. And they're, you know, I like that it's the really good stuff will actually get seen, and we don't have to sit through a Kramer versus Kramer to get to an ordinary people. You know what I mean?
Well, I think those are all fabulous points. You know, I thank you for those. I mean, it's very nice. I feel a lot better just being reminded that, you know, hey, that, you know, I mean, I whatever else may be going on in culture and media, you know, I have every episode of the Starland Vocal Band show on disc. I mean, you can find stuff if you look hard enough.
Yeah, I'm saying we're all in the same lifeboat, Chris. Man, yeah. I'm gonna show you. Hey, we still got oars, so. And those hardtack biscuits. We're all right for a while. Not great, well but what said, are you going to do?
Well said. Well said.
Is Hateful Eight worth seeing?
Hateful Eight is fucking phenomenal. If you like Quentin Tarantino. That's all I can say. I don't want to ruin anything about the movie. It is a Quentin Tarantino film.
Well, okay. Let me put a shade on that question. What if you're like more of a Jackie Brown Pulp Fiction Reservoir Dogs Tarantino, not so much a Django Unchained Kill Bill?
If I excise Jackie Brown from that, it's not Jackie Brown, but it is definitely Reservoir Dogs.
Oh, okay.
So right, it's cool. Definitely Reservoir Dogs. And if you're a film buff, you know, I'm going to not spoil, but give you something that occurred to me while I was watching it.
Okay.
There's a scene where one of the Blizzard's coming in, and they're talking about what they have to do to prepare for it. And one of the guys is starting to put stakes in the snow to go out to the outhouse, because they're like, well, we're going to have to go out to the outhouse. We got to put up a runner line. And I'm like, holy shit, this is the plot from The Thing. And that's what it is. It's the cowboy version of The Thing with no monster. Enjoy the movie, because it's really good.
All right, guys, I got to go. Get my kid from here.
Okay.
Give my best to the wife and kid.
Thanks. Chuck, Dan, Walt, who has already left us. Chris, glad you guys were able to join us.
Oh, okay.
It was fun.
Yep.
And we'll see you at the movies. We'll be the ones pissing and moaning, because it's Iron Man 6.
All right, talk to you guys later.